Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds, the associate producer of The Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, The Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, May 28th, Joe is joined by Joseph Palamountain, Junior Chair in Government at Skidmore College, Beau Breslin, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, and grants analyst based in Albany, Emily Honan.
We begin with a story that broke last night and still trying to, or still waiting for more details, but we're that are kind of dripping in, but there's a lot we don't know. The State Department on Tuesday suspended foreign students' visa appointments as it weighs expanded guidelines for screening applicants' social media accounts, according to an internal cable obtained by The Washington Post. Experts called it a troubling development in the Trump administration's campaign against universities that it says foster anti-Semitism. We'll get into that in a second, but Bob, can you real quick, and I know this is going to sound smart alecky, but what is an international cable?
Oh, so an international the cables are directives that come from the State Department to each of the consulates and embassies. So it's policy direction, and it goes back to days when it was actually a cable itself.
Okay, so it's not the means of transmission. It is the transmission.
It used to be the means of transmission. Now it's just that the term that they use for the directives coming out of the State Department.
I thank you for the clarification.
Foggy Bottom.
Effective immediately in preparation for an expansion of required social media screening and vetting, consular sections should not add any additional student or exchange visitor visa appointment, that's EMNJ, capacity until further guidance is issued, which will happen in coming days, and Cable said to agency staff. Unclaimed visa appointment times should, quote, immediately be removed from availability. The document was first reported by Politico. A senior State Department official confirmed to the Post the accuracy of the cable on the suspension of visa processing. The Trump administration has led an unyielding battle against universities that it alleges allow anti-Semitism, most recently attempting to bar Harvard from hosting international students and directing federal agencies to cancel or redirect contracts with the Ivy League school. The government also has orchestrated a crackdown on foreign national students who have expressed pro-Palestinian political beliefs, often citing social media posts and campus protests as grounds for detaining them and revoking their legal status. One more paragraph from the Washington Post, and I'll turn this over to our group. Much of these efforts, like Harvard certification to admit foreign students and student deportations, are mired in legal fights, but the administration has pressed forward to target visa processes. Homeland Security last month, citing White House executive orders aimed at addressing anti-Semitism, said it will begin screening non-citizen social media accounts for anti-Semitic content as reasons to deny visa and green card applications. Bob, my immediate question for you is, how many people is that?
We're talking a pretty large number. You know, I wanted to say over a million, but I don't know off the top of my head.
I mean that actually would then have anti-Semitic remarks on their social media.
I don't think the number is great.
I'm wondering, is this worth bringing this to a complete halt?
No.
To make sure that everyone's social media is scoured for however many you're going to find.
No, unfortunately, you know, I feel strongly that the issue of anti-Semitism is being used as a stalking horse, just to go after the international students and the universities and colleges, and for people at home who think, this isn't very exciting, let me see if I can frame this for folks. our colleges and universities have brought in international students who have then fallen in love with the country and either gone back to their own countries and become leaders of their countries, in which case they're sympathetic to us, which is part of soft power, or in many situations, have actually stayed here. So we've actually been robbing the rest of the world of some of the best and the brightest. And if you think about what's happened in Palo Alto with the growth of the tech boom, it is directly related to the strength of our university systems, but also the fact that we're bringing in these great minds who are then coming here and they're building our economy. So when we say, well, why is this important? It's important because it has an impact on our on future research and development. It has an impact on our position in the global order. It has a huge impact on the soft power that the United States has ridden on for a lot of years. And then it also has an economic impact both at the global level, but also at the state and local level. So it has a huge impact on the bottom line of the colleges and universities, but it also has a huge impact on these are students that won't be showing up, so they're not going to be renting places to live. They're not going to be buying from the stores. It adds to the general malaise in the overall economy. I'll also toss this because I want to sort of throw this out because it's a concern that I have. It's also another example of the administration working within the powers that it has. They have the power to check to see if people coming into the country are here on legitimate reasons. But it also is an expansion of what I view as sort of an authoritarian bend. And what really worries me is the fact that Congress is not having any oversight over the administration. State Department and now DHS will also be putting in tools that then can be used against us as citizens. So as they perfect the use of AI and as they perfect the use of scraping of social media, there aren't any guide rails in place that says that these same folks aren't going to start using them against us. And you say, well, Bob, you know, you sound awful paranoid. Given what we're seeing the administration do, how could I be anything but paranoid? So when you start to look at the situation, you're starting to see another effort from an administration that is willing to knock out one of the institutional pillars of American strength, and frankly, why the U.S. has had global dominance through both its scientific discoveries and its economy. That's why this story is so important to us.
But I'm also interested in that fact that this is a training ground for perhaps the future of streamlining this, a practice round to make sure that perhaps all of our social media can be scoured.
Well, and if there's nobody watching the watchers, who's going to say that this Department of Homeland Security or this Department of Defense, which I have zero faith in leadership in either of those institutions, certainly I have no faith in the Department of Justice right now, who is going to be watching government? And we're putting, again, these really sophisticated tools into the hands of government that I guess you just have to trust that they're not going to be misused. But that's where Congress's unwillingness to do the job that they're supposed to do becomes so important.
Emily.
Yeah, and I also think it's very important to remember that Trump's entire kingdom is built on a foundation of lies. They don't even have to find anything. Not only do they not have to find anything anti-Semitic, they can just lie and say whatever they did find was anti-Semitic. Even if they didn't find anything at all, they just say, oh, you know what? We found that. You can't talk about that. It's classified, and you're not coming to the country. Or you're getting kicked out of the country, or you don't get this federal job, or you can't keep your own job. And I know a lot of people are probably going to say, oh, well, we don't want terrorists in this country. I mean, you can't be posting anti-American stuff on social media and expect to get let into the country. That's not the point. This is a precedent. Every single thing that Trump has done has been testing the waters to see how much he can get away with before people realize, oh, I didn't speak for those people, and now there's no one left to speak for me.
Yeah. That idea of just of supplying the facts. I was watching the president yesterday talk about how no one from Harvard knows what the answer to 2 + 2, and they're just letting these people in, and they don't know anything. and why should we be spending money on them? And I was trying to follow along. I really was, Bo, but it was hard.
Absolutely, Joe. So let me throw out a couple what I would describe as hypocrisies, right? So I think there are a couple things that are interesting to think about. One is, remember the letter that he sends to Harvard, doubling down and on the idea of ideological diversity, right? This notion that somehow a particular perspective is not being represented in the liberal Harvard. How is this ideologically diverse to scour for particular messages and say, you know, no, you can't come into the country? Two.
Oh, I just thought it was funny how he wanted DEI for himself.
Yes, of course. Right. You know, what Bob said is absolutely true, and I'll just expand on it. About 10% of Skidmore students come from abroad, right? So they're going through this, and it's going to be a small number, but 10% of Skidmore students is about 300 students, and we're a small liberal arts college. It has made the college so much better. When I came in 1998, 1% of the students were international students. Now it's 10%. And the idea that you can have a rich, robust, liberal education today with just primarily white men is foolish, right? At the end of the day, we are gutting, Trump is gutting the institution, and I know that's what he's trying to do. But there's hypocrisy there in light of the fact that America First, we're the leading country when it comes to higher ed. Three, this didn't get a lot of attention, Joe, but let's talk about Marco Rubio, State Department. This is a State Department.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Rubio for a second. Rubio has four jobs, actually. He's still National Archives guy, and he's USAID. But he has two major jobs, right? And one of them is Secretary of State, and the other is NSA, his National Security Advisor. Those are incompatible, right? The Secretary of State is about negotiation. It's about diplomacy. And the NSA leader is about bombs and bullets, right? It's a better connection, a better grouping of that job if Trump had put the NSA director as the Secretary of Defense, not as Secretary of State. Couple more hypocrisies or ironies, and then I'll let it go. The fact that the president himself is the social media president, right? So here he is using his social network as a way to essentially get in office, and now social networking and Twitter and X and all those sorts of things is now his tool as ammunition against particular people. Finally, I'll say that, as Bob said, the economic impact is serious. The economic impact at colleges is serious. People will lose their jobs if visas are become difficult. We have several folks at Skidmore who just do student visas. They'll lose their jobs. So all of these things strike me as just hypocrisy and a certain sense of irony.
We are talking about the State Department on Tuesday suspending foreign students' visa appointments as it weighs expanded guidelines for screening applicants' social media accounts. That, according to an internal cable obtained by the Washington Post. We have heard from all of our panelists this morning, but Bob, I know there were a couple of points you wanted to make.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. There are a couple more points that I'll throw out for listeners to think about. One of the other concerns that I have is that as the government is getting better and better at scrubbing social media, it raises concerns in my mind about what is considered to be acceptable speech in postings, and in the longer term, it becomes part of a broader conversation about what does freedom of speech mean under this administration. But let me toss this at you. Is given what Rubio has set up, if I was an international student and I posted something saying, I support Amnesty International Day, I'm really worried about the starvation of children in Gaza, would that be considered to be a disqualifier? And the fact that there is no transparency about what we consider to be anti-Semitic versus just critical of governmental policies, it makes this a particularly slippery slope. I also really did appreciate the your comments about the NSA, about Rubio's multiple roles with the NSA. I actually took it in slightly different areas that. I think it shows how neutered the entire cabinet is. Yeah. That I really think that we're looking at a cabinet not of, 14, 15, 16 individuals, but rather two or three. In that, I see Project 25's fingers on this. I see Stephen Miller's fingers on this. I'm not sure that Rubio really is even running the State Department right now, which is in keeping with Trump, but it's also terrifying in the sense that as he grows more erratic, and you just simply need to look at his posts over the weekend, as he grows more erratic, one of the balances against a mad tyrant was the cabinet, right. And the fact that the cabinet is now so neutered that mechanism has been taken off the table.
There's also I would also say that the playbook has changed a little bit, right? Think about Doge coming in, Elon Musk coming in, eliminating a decent amount of jobs in the civil service. A lot of these operations no longer have the capacity to do the type of checking that this particular decree suggests. So really the formula for Trump administrative success is the scare tactic without the ability to be able to actually do the work necessary, because they've gutted the civil service in lots of different areas. So I think that's part of the equation is now they're just doing this. I'll also throw out there, don't forget that his first order of business in his first administration was the Muslim ban, right? That got overturned by the Supreme Court, and then he adds Venezuela and so on. This is just a clever way of sidestepping that and getting a similar outcome.
That was Bo Breslin on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, May 28th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, May 29th, Joe was joined by preceptor in public speaking for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson, professional speaker, speaking coach, and Albany County legislator, Mark Grimm, Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, and Associate Professor of Political Science at Marist University, Yiras Pupchenyk.
The big news last night was that the tariffs have been ruled illegal. And this, I think, is a fascinating story and one that deserves some of our attention. This morning, the U.S. Court of International Trade said the president had overstepped his authority in imposing his reciprocal tariffs globally, as well as levies on Canada and Mexico. This panel of federal judges on Wednesday blocked President Trump from imposing some of his steepest tariffs on China and other U.S. trading partners, finding that federal law did not grant him unbounded authority to tax imports from nearly every country around the world. The ruling by the U.S. Court of International Trade delivered an early yet significant setback to Mr. Trump, undercutting his primary leverage as he looks to pressure other nations into striking trade deals more beneficial to the United States. Before Mr. Trump took office, no president had sought to invoke the International Emergency and Economic Powers Act, a 1977 law, to impose tariffs on other nations. The law, which primarily concerns trade embargoes and sanctions, does not even mention tariffs. But Mr. Trump adopted a novel interpretation of its powers as he announced and then suspended high levies on scores of countries in April. He also used the law to impose tariffs on products from Canada and Mexico to, in return for what he said was their role in sending fentanyl to the United States of America. On Wednesday, the Court of International Trade, the primary federal legal body overseeing such matters, found that Mr. Trump's tariffs exceed any authority granted to the president by the Emergency Powers Law, ruling in separate cases brought by states and businesses. A bipartisan panel of three judges essentially declared many, but not all, of Mr. Trump's tariffs to have been issued illegally. It'll be interesting to see which ones stick and which ones don't. So what we're going to do, I think, is let me get the lay of the land here. I want to make sure we have time. Hey, Ray, is it okay if we get opening statements and then go over to you guys? Okay, let's do that. Terry Gibson, your thoughts.
Well, I think regardless of how you feel about tariffs, it's good to see that a court is actually holding this administration accountable and saying that, no, you do not have unchecked power. It's also interesting to see the arguments that are being made by the Trump administration, which are really based on what they say is a coherent plan that is going to be damaged if they're not able to apply these tariffs. And the judge is responding that it might be a great plan, but it doesn't abide by the law. We need to hear judges say that more often.
Judy Patrick.
You know, the executive's use of invoking an emergency, he's continuing to do that as a way of building power. And it's a troubling strategy or tactic on his part. It's something we should all be concerned about. Bottom line is businesses in America are confused. We don't know what's going to happen. This obviously will be appealed. I think they started the appeal process last night. So we don't know what will happen with tariffs. All I know is that Trump had a hissy fit last night or yesterday when someone made him aware of the taco trend, which is Trump always chickens out. He thought that was a very mean question, but it's a big meme on social media, the fact that he, you know, starts high. He says it's a negotiating tactic. People in other countries are saying he's just chickening out.
Wow. Mark.
Well, the question is, who sets policy in America? Have we changed? Because we have elections. The elected a president, elected the House, elected the Senate to set policy, not the courts. And what we've seen is this flood of lawsuits against Trump because he wants to do what he said he was going to do during the campaign. And he won all seven contested states that were the key states. So is this constitutional or not? Well, that's yet to be determined. It's being appealed. But what I'm really concerned about is this idea: if you lose election, you don't accept the election, you sue over policy, and the policy should be set by the president, the House, and Senate. And if you don't like the policy, you should elect a different president, House, and Senate.
But okay, two things. One, isn't though, the fact that this is a court with many judges that were named by Donald Trump. And I would argue with you that I don't remember hearing these incredible 135% tariffs on countries being an election issue.
Oh, he talked about tariffs, beautiful tariffs. He talked about tariffs a lot. Now, the question is, but in the court said yesterday that some of the tariffs are okay and some of them aren't. So it's a little inconsistent, it seems to me, that we're going to let these judges decide what appropriate the tariffs are. The higher courts are going to decide whether it's constitutional or not. But clearly, tariffs were an important part of the president's campaign. And from a reasonable standpoint, if a country says we're going to impose a 25% tariff on everything you try to import, the idea that we can't say, oh, we're going to have a 25% tariff to make it fair, that seems to me a very reasonable position. So let's wait to see what the higher courts do.
Juris.
Okay. Well, Trump never promised incremental change, right? He ran on the platform that he will change the way things are being done in Washington, and he's known to do a lot of things to challenge the status
Correct.
Quo, right? So, you know, his interpretation of this little-known 1970s Powers Act to justify tariffs will be challenged in courts. I mean, I think everyone expected that, including Trump, and now it's being challenged. Of course, Trump is appealing it, and eventually it's probably going to end up very quickly, I would guess, in Supreme Court. And historically, Supreme Court tends to rule in favor of executive branch.
So when we look at one of the lines that I read in the article, Judy, was that this group quickly made this decision, which I thought was an interesting choice of words given the fact that these tariffs have been in place and we've been sort of working on this issue for 2 months, and I would have thought it would have come sooner then.
Agreed, and I was a little surprised. I thought I knew the court system, and I didn't realize this court even existed.
I didn't want to say that out loud, but I didn't know either.
Who did?
And you know, to follow the rationale that, you know, courts shouldn't be overruling executive actions, then let's just get rid of the courts if that's the logic here. I mean, we have courts like this to make these kinds of decisions. My understanding is the tariffs on automobiles, on aluminum, on steel will remain, and the Mexico and Canadian ones maybe as well. But I think what people who voted for Donald Trump believed was that there would be a more systematic or targeted approach to tariffs. This whole idea of, you know, every time there's a controversial Trump a policy that's enacted, I get the, oh, well, that's what people voted for. Well, people didn't vote for, you know, deporting, you know, people without any criminal history. You know, it's a whole bunch. It's the rationale falls flat for me.
We're talking about the fact that Trump's Liberation Day tariffs have been halted by Court of International Trade. Most of President Trump's tariffs were halted late Wednesday by a U.S. trade court in a sharp rebuke of the president's signature trade war policy. This is interesting because we're not exactly sure which ones are and which ones aren't, but also many of these were on hold in some way or at least reduced. So to get sort of a full, if you remember during the Liberation Day ceremony, there was the chart. And so we have to look at that chart and figure out where it is now, and assuming all of that's off the table. But not exactly sure how that works as of now, and we'll see what the trade court does as they continue this, because as we said, this is under appeal. The trade court's ruling that Trump exceeded his authority in imposing tariffs on all imported goods brought an immediate, albeit perhaps temporary, halt to his signature trade war policy. The challenge tariff orders will be vacated and their operation permanently enjoined, according to this three-judge panel. Future contracts on the S&P 500 stock index jumped 1.4% on the news, but a few hours later, the Justice Department said in a federal court filing that it will appeal. The trade court's decision in a pair of lawsuits filed last month against the government applies to the 10% tariffs that Trump imposed on all foreign products, as well as much higher levies applied to goods from several dozen nations. The president invoked a 1977 law, as we mentioned, that granted him emergency powers over the economy, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or the IEEPA, for those of you keeping score at home. The trade court's ruling also freezes separate tariffs on Mexican, Canadian, and Chinese goods, which Trump imposed to coerce those governments into taking action to counter human and drug trafficking. But import taxes on specific products, such as automobiles, auto parts, steel, and aluminum, will remain in effect. Terry Gibson, what does that, where does that leave us at this awkward moment?
Well, I think it's important that we keep this whole case in perspective, because it's clear that there are multiple different ways that the president does have legal authority to impose tariffs. Some of those ways do require congressional approval. Some of those ways do not. This ruling is about a very specific way that the Trump administration has decided to do it, based on a very specific law. This court is saying that using that law to justify the tariffs is illegal and unconstitutional, however you want to say it. It's going to be appealed to at least one, if not two, higher courts, maybe the Supreme Court. All that to say that no matter how this turns out, there's still going to be tariffs. There's still going to be a way for the Trump administration, just as there was a way for the Biden administration, to levy tariffs. So tariffs aren't going away. The question here is, how much power does a president have to unilaterally, without reporting to anyone, how much power do they have to actually imply these tariffs? And that, I think that's what's going to be resolved here. And I think that's important to have a constitutional understanding of where that line is. And I'm not sure we understand where that line is right now. It's also important to point out that this case is partly brought by businesses that are part of a case that is being represented by a conservative-leaning organization that's all about trying to stop government overreach, which is kind of interesting because some of the people that support this organization, the Liberty Justice Center, are people that supported Trump. So I think that that's interesting as well. And if you look at the stock market today, stock markets really like the fact that some of these tariffs might be going away. So lots of things to talk about and think about here.
Yours?
That was a really good assessment, actually. So where are we now with regards to the tariffs? Yeah, I don't see them going away. And even if you look at the ruling, which I quickly skimmed last night, just kind of like seeing what's going on, you know, it basically gives Trump's administration, the way I understand it, 10 days to make it right, what the court, the smaller court, wants his administration to do. But it's already being appealed, and I mean, there'll be appeal upon appeal, and right, one way or the other, I think Trump will find ways to have tariffs in place. And from Trump's perspective, United States is the strongest economic power globally. You know, it can apply tariffs to pressure other countries into doing what it wants. And I mean, he'll keep on trying to do that through one way or the other.
Mark?
Yeah, I think tariffs, as they pointed out, tariffs are not new. Trump didn't invent tariffs. So yes, presidents can use tariffs to have a fair trading system, and it really hasn't been fair to us. So should we just not try to change it? Now, of course, if there's something unconstitutional about what he's doing, the courts, it's the court's role to step in and say that's unconstitutional. But I wouldn't say just because one court has ruled a certain way, that's where we're going to end up. And I know there's confusion, and that affects the markets because the markets want as much certainty as possible. But the reason for the confusion is Trump's a negotiator. And you talk about his chart, and nobody expects that chart to be the final product. He's trying to apply as much pressure as he can. And you know what? We're the consumer giant. We consume well over $20 trillion a year, I think, buying products and services. The next closest one is China at 7.5. So we have to use our buying power to our advantage, and that's really what Trump is trying to do. And if this is ruled unconstitutional, I'm sure they'll try another path to straighten out what is currently an unfair tariff system.
Judy?
So this is all about consolidating and establishing power. could have gone to Congress and sought approval for these tariffs, but he intentionally wants the Supreme Court to rule on this. And there's a lot of cases like this, from some of the cases where he's deported people to that. He could have gone to Congress and sought the approval, and he's got Congress in his pocket. They would approve it. But instead, he wants the Supreme Court because he believes the Supreme Court will rule in his favor. Another thing about this stay or whatever the court decided, they've stayed the that loophole involving imports of less than $800, which will affect the fast fashion industry. You know, the people who buy the $4 or $5 T-shirts from Temu and Shein, I think, are the two things that has been put on hold. I think that was considered a major win for people who like to buy a lot of consumable clothing, or the rubber ducks, or all sorts of things from the Chinese market from at a low cost. So I just think Trump is playing the courts, you know, and the result is confusion among businessmen who don't know, or business people who do not know, you know, when to order their imports, whether to go out of business. I don't know when to buy a new washing machine. I just, you know, and I need one.
Yeah,
I'll just hang on. It's a confusion. There's a strategy to negotiating, and they could have been doing this, you know, behind closed doors. You know, I'm always for one for transparency, but this could have been done behind closed doors, so we're not rocketing the market back and forth. The market's up this morning, but I haven't enjoyed the roller coaster my 401k has been on the last. Since Liberation Day or Freedom Day or whatever it was.
That was Judy Patrick on the Roundtable Panel on Thursday, May 29th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, May 30th, Joe was joined by Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont, Professor Emeritus of Russian at Hofstra University and author of A Liberal Vanguard, Populist Elitism in the United States and Russia, Alexander Mihailovich, and Professor of Economics at Siena College, Aaron Pasitti.
Aaron, let's talk about tariffs. We'll all talk about tariffs, but I'm going to start with Aaron, and we'll get him in before the break at 9:30. But tariffs were the court said no, and then yesterday the court said yes. So the tariffs are on for now, thanks to an appeals court, in a win for Trump less than 24 hours after another court, which I still don't completely understand the Court of International Trade, but maybe you can help us with that as well. They ruled Wednesday that most of Trump's tariffs were illegal and must be halted. And then the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit said Thursday that it would temporarily pause the effects of the decision from the Court of International Trade. So we're supposed to have whiplash.
Yes, this is even tough for me to follow. So with that preface, so the justification for most of the tariffs, the reciprocal tariffs that were announced on Liberation Day, came from the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977, which gives the president a fair amount of authority to regulate a lot of international economic transactions. And it arose because of the Iran hostage crisis. So it gives the president power to act without congressional approval to freeze assets, to impose regulations, to impose sanctions on countries that pose a national security threat. So that was the premise for a lot of the Liberation Day tariff. So that's kind of the background. So if you're going to use that, Trump had to claim some type of economic and national security threat. And this is where things get beyond muddy, because he claimed that the large U.S. trade deficit was the national security threat. Well, the trade deficit has been large since the early 1980s. So I'm not sure what's new about, 2025. And it was probably the flimsiest of justifications. So I'm not surprised that the U.S. Court of International Trade, who regulates a lot of the legality surrounding trade agreements between different countries, ruled that there is no emergency. You can't do this. We have a 4.2% unemployment rate, which is the lowest it's been since the late 1960s. Inflation's come down to 2.5%. Wage growth is in excess of 3%. So it's tough to tell what economic emergency he was appealing to or using to justify these tariffs. So I'm not surprised the court ruled that he didn't have the legal authority to impose tariffs on, islands that only have penguins on them. What is it? Hart and McDonald Islands. Tough to tell how penguins are a threat to national security, let alone some of our biggest trading partners like the EU and Canada. Mm-hmm. So there's another act, and that is the 1962 Trade Expansion Act, which gives the president to impose tariffs when imports threaten or impair our national security. So it's very similar to the Emergency Economic Powers Act, but the 1962 Trade Expansion Act is more focused on trade. So that was the justification used for a lot of the earlier tariffs, the steel and aluminum tariffs that he imposed on Canada, some tariffs on cars and car parts. But again, it's tough to see how that constitutes any type of national emergency when we've spent decades building global supply chains and a very integrated North American production system. So normally when you impose tariffs, the Secretary of Commerce does an investigation to kind of examine the details, figure out just how much of a threat it poses, what actions can be taken. That gets reviewed, that gets sent to the president. None of that was followed. Howard Lutnick just rubber stamped it and said, sure, whatever you say goes. So there was no Secretary of Commerce investigation into this. So all of these tariffs are based on really, really flimsy legality. And that's what the Wednesday ruling with the U.S. Court of International Trade said. You just can't do this. Mm-hmm. You can negotiate tariff agreements or trade agreements between individual nations as the president sees fit. But to just impose these broad-based tariffs certainly violates the legality of the law. And then yesterday, big surprise, another court came in and said, we're going to pause this ruling. So it's not ruling on the merits. It's just saying we need time to look into this. So it overturned the original Wednesday ruling.
Aaron Bassetti was telling us about the back-and-forth nature of court action and tariffs. And I believe we got up to the point where the court acted yesterday and said, okay, we're going to, while this court said that this is illegal, we are now going to look at this. But while we look at this, the tariffs are allowed to continue.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Now, just out of curiosity, wouldn't it be easier to just say, and I don't know the answer to this, that's why I'm asking you, we're going to figure this out, and if it is illegal, maybe we won't do it. We'll just keep it the way it is until we find out whether it is or not.
It's,
or doesn't it work like that?
It's not with Trump. The policy changes by the day, right? There was the
But I mean the court.
The court.
I mean, oh. As far as the court saying that, I mean, the court could have said, okay, we are going to, we want this to go back to the to another court to investigate, right? Mm-hmm. But we will allow the hold to stay in place until we investigate.
But the tariffs have, I mean, the tariffs haven't been deemed to violate any law yet.
Okay.
So I think that's why they're allowed. So I think that's why they are allowed to remain in place.
Allowed to continue. Yeah. Okay.
A question though, Aaron. I mean, are the tariffs actually being applied already, or is there a waiting period? I thought that there's a pause of about 2 weeks before the matter is actually settled.
Right.
Is that correct?
And then there's the 90-day pause that Trump put into effect once bond markets started tanking in early April. So keeping track of what's in effect where, with whom and where is head spinning.
Right. As are the complexities of this whole matter.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, just in terms of Trump's own coalition, because one of the organizations that stepped forward to oppose the tariffs, these particular tariffs, is the Liberty Justice Center, which is a libertarian organization that, among other people, Rand Paul has been very supportive of. And so if you look at the court order, it's a kind of a head spinning, talk about head spinning, agglomeration of states, multiple states in the union are, supporting the stay of the tariffs, in addition to all sorts of companies. There's a plastics company, there's a wine importing company, perhaps not altogether surprisingly, given, how they would be affected by the tariffs. And a couple of other, companies, sort of small corporations. And so there's that aspect of it, that's sort of interesting, the way this all shows up the fissures within Trump's coalition. The other thing I just want to, and this is kind of a sort of a sidebar, but the title of the article in the Post was "Tariffs are on for now thanks to appeals court in win for Trump." This is, among recent things that I've read in the press, this is one of the times where I'm especially struck by the gap between the article's title and the actual content. This is the Washington Post. This is not really a win for Trump. I mean, it's a stay. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so,
well, let's remember who owns the Washington Post and some of his recent editorial.
Jeff Bezos, who has, a bit of an axe to grind in terms of mollifying the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that also, again, this is a sidebar, but there's something to think about.
My turn.
Your turn.
Whiplash is one thing. So I think from sort of a larger perspective, this illustrates the overall strategy, once again, of the Trump administration, which is to both justification shop and venue shop when they're trying to just impose a number of different actions for the administration to take, especially in the area of international affairs, whether it's increased deportations or I know we're going to get to some of these other topics this morning, how international students are managed in the United States to these tariffs and just this extraordinarily broad view of presidential power. And they will take it everywhere they can, as far as they can. So whether the original justification is, as Aaron pointed out, flimsy on its surface, then they'll refine it. They'll see how the courts respond. But I think the strategy is to take action as quickly as possible and then refine the response based on how the legal system tries to manage that. And the legal system is trying to deal with all these things. It's by design and by procedure, it's slower than an executive type authority is. And so we're going to continue to see in a number of areas, headlines where a Trump administration takes action X, and then people may sort of be like, oh, you know, oh no, or how, what are the consequences of that? Or and just a lot of confusion and concern about the implications, the consequences of that. And then the courts will weigh in a little bit later, and there may be a stay, there may be a pause, there may not be a pause. And so I think it's very, it becomes even more difficult for the average citizen to follow what's going on and understand the implications. So one of the things I've been thinking about is just sort of imagining if I were the managing editor of the New York Times, how would I manage my newsroom in this situation? I mean, it seems like you really need to restructure. You need to pull in people who have kinds of expertise that haven't been as necessary in previous years. You because so many actions are being taken throughout the executive branch that are not readily apparent. But they have wide-reaching implications. And if you don't have people sort of assigned to who really understand, you know, the federal government or the court system, if you don't have people assigned to watch those things specifically, then it's just not going to get out there. And so I know there are a lot of things happening throughout the executive branch that have wide-reaching implications that just aren't rising to the level of headline. And it's not only because only the most potentially devastating headlines like these tariffs are making it to the sort of top of the front page. But I think it's also because newsrooms, and I'm not saying this as a knock on the media, I'm just sort of observing what I think is the truth. I think newsrooms are not as well equipped as we need in this moment to sort of follow the details of where these policies are actually being implemented and what their effects might be.
Aaron?
So, yes, I think Malia's right, and I also think that's part of the broader strategy of just what Steve Bannon's muzzle velocity phrase. The interesting thing here is that, remember, Trump has a Republican Congress. There would have been, it would be very easy to pass a broader piece of legislation through Congress regarding international trade policy, not this haphazard, you know, have ChatGPT figure out what reciprocal tariffs look like and then have a poster board that nobody can read in the Rose Garden. But, you know, that's not his style. So there's three issues that I want to really address because we can talk about the legal rulings and what this does and what that does. And the first thing that this accomplishes or fails to accomplish is that businesses can deal with higher costs, whether it's Amazon, whether it's General Motors, whether it's a smaller mom-and-pop hardware store. Businesses can easily adjust to higher costs. They can take lower profit margins. They can raise prices. They can figure out ways to improve productivity and efficiency. So tariffs are not a major issue for businesses, provided they're not, you know, 200% or something. What businesses can adapt to and what poses the bigger threat to the U.S. economy and what a lot of policymakers like Jerome Powell at the Federal Reserve and others are saying is that the biggest risk to the economy is the uncertainty. Businesses can't deal with uncertainty, right? So if you're building a high-rise apartment building in New York City and it's half complete, do you buy more steel now? Do you wait? Do you put it on pause and wait 2 years, hoping that the tariffs get overruled and that the tariffs are out? So the uncertainty, whether it's with consumers, not knowing if car prices are going to be 25% higher next year, do you buy now? Do you wait? When consumers and businesses face uncertainty, they freeze. They just stop and wait for the waters to clear and then make action in the future. But when that happens, that slows economic activity, and that's a big reason that a lot of people are forecasting a recession. The other issue is the whole concept of the trade deficit as a threat to the U.S. economy is nonsense. I run a trade deficit with Stewart's. I give them a lot of my money, and they don't give me any money back. But I get goods and services from Stewart's. I run a trade deficit with Home Depot and Lowe's, because when I go there to buy stuff, I give them my money and they don't give me any money back. But they do give me goods and services. It's the same principle with international trade. We give other countries money, and they give us things that we either can't produce ourselves, like, say, coffee or, I don't know, not semiconductors, other types of, you know, produce. And then we supply them with things that they can't make. That's the whole logic of free trade. And that's why you see libertarian organizations, including, I found myself nodding my head in the few days after Liberation Day, agreeing with the Wall Street Journal's editorial board, being like, yeah, this is disastrous. You can say what you want about free trade and libertarians and how it's approached, but it's the uncertainty issue. If the goal is to, as Trump states, to bring back manufacturing jobs, there's other ways to do that. Biden's CHIPS Act was a good example, right? You have industrial policy and federal spending that incentivizes domestic production. Just making foreign goods more like taxing cars and semiconductors doesn't mean that all of a sudden by the end of 2025, we're going to have 1,000 new car plants and semiconductor plants. Those take years, if not decades, to build. You have to, you know, source products, get supply chains in order. That's just a fantasy. And that brings me to the third topic, which is then what is he doing? What's the ultimate goal here? And I know, I mean,
which brings me to the third topic. What the hell is going on?
Yeah. No, I use different language at home.
Sure. But we all do.
So, I mean, listen, Scott Bessent and Lutnick both know this is not going to work. This is going to create a lot of economic uncertainty. There's a couple of hypotheses. There's the conspiratorial one, which is the taco trade, that if you look at stock markets, he announces tariffs, they drop. He says tariffs are off. They come back up. It looks like a taco shell.
Right.
That there might be some insider trading going on, not with him specifically, but with his network and tentacles of
the
firms.
The orbit.
Mm-hmm. And then the second thing, so working on that taco acronym, Trump always chickens out. He's lost all of the leverage he claimed to claims to have had once he backed off of the tariffs after Liberation Day. So he is in a far weaker position to negotiate anything, which brings me to the third topic. And this is what I think, or the third hypothesis, which I think what he's really doing, this is just a dominance display. This is a silverback gorilla thumping his chest to get world leaders to come to the White House and give them a public dressing down so he can appear strong and then claim victory for some mild, insignificant accomplishment.
And, you know, Aaron, you were saying this confuses even me, and you're an economist, and I think a lot of us are feeling confusion, a lot of us going back and forth. Does the confusion help or hurt the Trump administration effort?
That's a good question. Yeah, I'm going to talk out of both sides of my mouth here. It helps the Trump administration because it provides a distraction for more nefarious things they might be up to. So you can look at this as just a distraction from, I don't know, deporting people to South Sudan, right? That this is a more innocuous way to get the news media's eyes away from that. But I think, and you're already starting to see consumer sentiment plunge. You're seeing business confidence plunge because of the uncertainty. This is going to destroy Republicans in the 2026 midterm. So does it help Trump and the Trump administration in the short term? Yes, by distracting people and the news media from other issues. In the longer term, the effect this is going to have on the economy, I think, whether or not people believe tariffs work, Trump's not going to be able to deny once grocery prices start going up and car prices start going up and the light manufactured goods we ordered from Amazon start going up. So once that hits, which a lot of economists say will take time, probably later this summer, early this fall, I think that's going to really, really hurt the Trump administration.
That was Aaron Pasitti on the Roundtable panel on Friday, May 30th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable Panel The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.